to Richard Durlacher, Mr. Robert Wilson Stevens. Could you first tell me how it was that you met?
We met because the two firms, Bernald and Morton and Seal, which Robert started with, and the firm that I was with, which was F&N Durlacher, we used to run a joint book in brewery shows. The division was north and south of the country. If I remember rightly, we had the most of the southern brewers, and you had the northern ones.
That's right, it was purely a line down the middle, and we shared the profit.
And then we had the only one that we had, which we dealt in distillers, and I don't think you dealt in distillers in those days.
That's correct.
And about when did this occur?
Well, this must have happened immediately after the war.
Well, with respect, I think actually it happened during the war, Dick, didn't it? Because a lot of people were away in the war, and I don't think the old bone side had the people really to run the business. And therefore, I have a feeling that we were large. I think you've effectively ran the quite a few of the books, and we shared the profits. I think it happened actually then, as my understanding. I may be wrong.
No, but it surprises me that the actual merger between the two firms then didn't take place until
1960. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You would have thought it would have been logical if we'd have got together sooner.
Well, I think what actually happened also was that you had a 10-year gap, really. First, there was 5 years' war. Then you had a Labour government, and they were bent on nationalising, whether it was the mines or the railways, and
steel.
All sorts of other things were threatened. And therefore, business on the stock exchange was at a pretty low ebb right through the 40s. And it was only when you had the return of a Conservative government, I think it was at 51, or yes, 51, that things started to pick up, and then business picked up, and then one suddenly realised the logic of having been joint book that really we'd be far better if we were one firm. I suspect that was the way your father and Nigel Morton saw it.
Yes, and I think also thinking back that it was the fact that you had your well ensconced in our offices and we were well ensconced in our offices, and we had to look for a very much bigger building, and ours was the first of the large open plan dealing floors that were put into any stockjobber's office. And we managed to do that because we bought it was a part of the bomb site. It was just the south side of the that vast great Barbican area, which was desolate and bombed until the mid-60s, I think. And they put up a house on the continuation of London Wall where it crosses Moorgate called Austral House. And we moved in there and we managed to take two floors one above the other, so it was all open plan. So we had our key and lamp units, which were very modern. We thought it was quite convenient. It was about 10 minutes away from the Bank of England, 10 minutes away from the Stock Exchange, obviously. People tell us that we were mad because nobody thought that anybody could operate that vast distance, because they were thinking about CADs, that's cash against delivery, gilt, all the gilts had to go back to the bank. They thought none of our customers would come and see us. And now, of course, when you look at the diversified, well, there is no market left, but all the securities houses spread from Victoria through around the EC2 area, the Stock Exchange area, all the way to Finsbury. Oh.
The extraordinary thing about that, Dick, is that it was the vision of your father. And, of course, the dealing room, and people came to see it from far and wide because it was something very new. But, in fact, you see, it was really only used for a quarter of the day, because we went there first thing in the morning. Then we went to the floor of the Stock Exchange, 9:15 or thereabouts, and we were there till 3:30. So it was really only used as the extension of the floor of the Stock Exchange for about 2 hours a day. But even so, it proved absolutely invaluable, didn't it?
Yep.
And of course, having set it up, we then started other firms came in. And when one thought initially, I mean, it was diamond-shaped, if I remember rightly, or sort of a flat-sided diamond, initially. And then rapidly, because of the advent of other firms, we had to put in desks at the side, and certainly at the sides, didn't we, for additional dealing desks.
Right. Let's go back a little bit in time, more or less to the beginning. When did you join the Stock Exchange, Dick?
51.
Had you done that after finishing school?
I had a year's farming. I was going to the army and I wasn't accepted because I had asthma. And I went straight into the office, £2 a week, probably overpaid.
And that was when we
were, that was when we were Effenand & Lacker, and there were under a dozen people in toto in the firm. We dealt solely in brewery shares, as I said, and distillers in those days. Before that, we had, before the war, we dealt in the rubber market, of course, that side of the window by then. And I worked my way through as a blue button clerk, having been through the office. I went through the office for 2 years. Then went as a blue button onto the floor of the Stock Exchange for about 3 or 4 years, I think, and then became a partner, I think, the year after you did.
I think before.
1958, I think it was.
No, you were before. You're that much older than I. No, you were a partner before I am. Were you with Messel for a short while?
Yes, I spent a year with Messel.
Seeing the other side of it.
Messel and Kerr were stockbrokers who got taken over by Sherson's, and now, of course, the name is gone completely. Anyway, we won't be too critical about the opposition, but they still don't shine with glory in the city now. Anyway, it was most interesting. My career with Messel was not any interesting, but it was most useful to see the stockbroker's worries when dealing with stock jobbers, because obviously it wasn't all harmony and peace and goodwill. We had our rows, and it really wasn't until bargains became recorded that it was dictum meum pactum, and usually, first of all, that the broker tried to make the jobber take the losses if there were losses. And if that couldn't be resolved, usually we settled 50-50.
Robert, when did you enter the Stock Exchange?
I did 2 years national service, then I tried to become an accountant and decided that certainly wasn't for me. That took a year roughly to work that one out. My father was a broker, and I was interested in the Stock Exchange, and I would have been interested to become a broker, but he said, well, why not see the other side of it, the jobbing side first? And so I went to the old Bone Oldham firm under Sir Nigel Morden, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and I couldn't see any point. I mean, they were short of staff in any case, and really to go broking, there was no point when I was enjoying what I was doing. And so that was 1955.
How would you describe the firm at that time? Was it a very similar firm to Effenand & Lacker?
I think it was. I think we were 50 in all, including the office staff. We dealt in the breweries, a certain number of industrials, mainly in the sort of paint, food, those markets. But it was an absolute tiny bite of the whole market compared with what we ended up dealing in.
And I understand that both of your firms were already running some joint books with each other.
I think the idea of a joint book needs to be clarified, really, doesn't it, Dick? I mean, there are two aspects of a joint book. I mean, a joint book can either be where you're both actually dealing in the same shares, which is rather complicated, but there were a few of those around, and they were supposed to be published. We did not duplicate any of the shares in which the two firms dealt in.
Companies.
Exactly. What we did was we shared the profits on a varying basis. For instance, I think the breweries was strictly 50-50. But as far as some of the equity is concerned, I think it was 70-30. It might have even been 75-25. It varied. That was a Stock Exchange rule, actually, that you could only be joint with one firm. Now, we had the most extraordinary unofficial relationship with a firm called Pinching, because they dealt, and we, the Bone side of things, actually dealt in cable shares, I mean, BIC cables and telephone rentals and things like that. We had an unofficial joint book with them, and it was strict. Everybody knew about it, but strictly speaking, because you could only have one joint book, it was against the rules. But the fact that
we didn't deal in that market made it in the eyes of the stock exchange. They knew about it.
Yeah.
Nothing too on down.
How would you describe the jobbers generally at this time in the 1950s? There were a lot more jobbing firms.
There were hundreds of jobbing firms. Yeah. I think when I first joined, there must have been about 300 or so.
Oh.
But there again, they weren't real jobbing firms. There were a lot of one and just two members who were acting like a $2 broker in the States. If people went out to lunch, they used to, out of charity, say, "Oh, no, execute this order for me, old chum," and they used to take a penny a share on it or whatever.
They really were the sort of forerunners, I think, of the professional dealer. They largely carried out the professional broker's dealer's function, because, take my own father, for instance. He used to talk to his clients in a telephone room, then he'd come into the market and execute the orders and actually buy or sell, given what he was asked to do. Well, they used to have, supposing they had a lot of orders, and they just couldn't actually do it. So some firms used to go to these little sort of tuppenny halfpenny so-called jobbers, hand him a list, and one used to stand next door to me. It always used to amaze me. And I would know that I was calling wires 21 and 39. And this chap would say, "Sell you 500, and I'd buy 500 at 21 and 3. And then I would see that he booked down 500 at 21 and a penny halfpenny. And I mean, this seemed crooked to me, to be honest, because it wasn't the price that he dealt at, and I knew that that was his penny halfpenny, and that was what his commission, if you like, for carrying out that order. And that's how they functioned, and very rarely did they perform the function which we ultimately knew as jobbing. They negotiated effectively. And then, of course, this came to be seen as wrong. And so, again, back to my father, if you like, and many other firms, they then hired themselves professional dealers who carried out their orders. And they only dealt, I mean, they spent most of their time, in fact, a lot of them then left the floor of the stock exchange, the sort of senior partners, they all operated up in their offices and sent down their orders to the box or to the floor, and they were carried out like that. And I think that had a lot to do with the demise of those sort of...
So a broker never gave a part of his commission...
Rather than knocking off a penny off the price
that they had received from the job, which should have gone to the client, the customer.
Indeed.
Did the client sometimes get 21 and threepence, say, in this particular instance, which you mentioned,
yes,
and then had a penny halfpenny out of the broker's commission?
I don't know what went on there, Dick. I mean, you could share commission, couldn't you, I believe?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Because we never saw this.
We didn't see that side.
Mercer was a very large firm in those days, and they had all their own dealers in place.
But I think people sometimes get the wrong impression about the sort of demise of the jobbing system. They say there were 200-300 jobbers, and then we eventually, it came down to five worthwhile ones, I was fair to say, and then a few other sort of fringe ones. But they, like Tony Jenkins, if you like, because he was specialising in and very successfully in a particular market. But you're not, of the five that remained and the 200-odd that were mentioned, you're not really discussing like with like, to my way of thinking. They were a very different animal.
Well, Dick, how would you contrast those smaller firms with your own firm and with firms like Byrne Oldham?
When I first joined?
Yes.
Well, we were just part of the market, and we were a smallish firm in those days. My father was senior partner, and he saw the way of things and decided to expand. And that was the beginning of this, from 1951 to when we joined up with Byrne Oldham, and then from there on, between us, as I say, we ended up with a firm called De Lac & Morton.
WDM, indeed.
Which incorporated 32 other firms. Mm. I think we were 34 in total, weren't we?
Something like that, yeah. Mm.
What inspired your father to think ahead in that way? Whereas a lot of other older senior partners in jobbing firms were quite happy to retire and take their money out. Others were quite happy to be merged in other bigger firms.
He was very forward-looking. He didn't just cast his eyes around the floor of the stock exchange. He spent a lot of his time going around talking to all the boards, the chairman of companies in which we dealt, finding out what their requirements were. This led to us speaking and having to lunch the finance directors and the managing directors, the chairman of those companies in which we dealt. And because of those meetings, they used to say, well, I wish that you wouldn't deal in Hawker Siddeley on the motor book. That should be dealt in on the engineering book. And then if we found that the shares were very unmarketable, very high priced, and the high price share in those days was £5, it's nothing today, but it was then, we'd say, right, if you give us a share split, we'll move the stock over. Because they didn't mind it being dealt in on the motor book, per se, physically on the floor of the stock exchange. But if it was dealt on the motor book, it appeared in the stock exchange daily official list as being a motor share rather than an engineering share. So I think that father was responsible for a very good rapport growing up between the market makers and not having to rely on the brokers, entirely on the brokers. The brokers didn't like it very much. They thought that we were trying to tread on their patch, and it was quite harmless because we weren't allowed to deal, as you know, no jobber is allowed to deal directly with any customer. They have to deal through a broker.
One of the other marked things I think he did, he had amazing foresight. And one of the most obvious things he did, it's a matter of detail, but for instance, when I mentioned BI cables, wires, if you dealt in the ordinary, you also dealt in the 7% preference, the 3.5% convertible loan, and any other bit of rubbish there was, all in the same book. And of course, fixed charges, as we called them, were a totally different animal, mainly related to sort of interest rates. And he put an end to that and set up a complete section of the firm which dealt in all, originally, as I say, the fixed charges and indeed the convertibles, although we took that one stage eventually and had a separate convertible book when in fact more came along. But in those days there were a lot of stocks which fell into that category, and they were quite profitable.
Likewise, we used to deal in the options when options came in on the same book. This is much later. And we used to get into the most frightful pickle until we realised, of course, that the options had to be separated out and run by a professional dealer on their own. So that was rather a bit parallel.
We used to play around and thought we were quite clever, made a complete.
But we always used to forget to exercise the option.
That was traditional options. Obviously, there weren't any traded options in those days.
How would you describe the senior partners in your firm before you merged with Billacker, for example?
They were all working on a book for a start, and indeed so was your father in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But they all stood on the floor of the market. I think the office manager had quite a lot of influence in those days. He sort of ran the office side of things. He sort of produced, if they wanted some blue buttons or whatever, he looked around or he fed them down to the market. And as I say, certainly Nigel Morden, he adored dealing. And really, if you had some sort of problem, to get him away from the book took a lot of doing, because he was a good dealer. In those days, he was an enormous sort of bull dealer, and I think that was part of the success of our merger, wasn't it? Because I think the Dallaca firm, certainly your dear cousin Jack in particular, was a very good, very great bear, and we were always bullish. I remember Jack accused me of being a bull for 20 years, eventually he agreed that I could be a bear, but it wasn't strictly true. But that was one of the successes of the merger, I think.
What were the main attractions of the merger from the point of view of your firm?
Well, I think one saw the way things were going, and that if we were going to be able to compete, I think you needed the size and the increase in capital behind you. And, of course, I suppose when other firms came in eventually, as we both mentioned, the number of stocks that we dealt in or markets we dealt in was comparatively limited. And sometimes there was very little interest. There was always a fair amount of interest actually in the breweries. But some markets would go out of fashion, there wouldn't be a great deal of interest in them. And therefore, if one spread one's interest, one could foresee that there would always be some sort of turnover in one or two of those markets, and it was no use. You couldn't just sort of take up a stock tomorrow because you saw there was some activity in a particular market. You needed to be basically there. That was rather a convention. I mean, you could, but you didn't.
And another big attraction, of course, the cost savings yeah. in the back office.
Yeah.
We were the first person, first firm to go onto a computerized back office systems. We took in Hollerith for all the sorting, and we took in ICL. We did a joint deal with Joe Lance.
I was going to say, we had a thing called Leo, didn't we?
And we had Leo, which I tell you,
great.
It was about three times the size of this room,
yeah.
standing flat on its side. Yeah. And you could put it fairly comfortably on one segment of this desk today.
Mm.
And it was for years and years and years a showpiece in Whiteley's.
Mm.
People just go and look at it and wonder what it was.
Yeah, you were also one of the first firms to have a stats department.
Oh, no, we weren't. Bernard had the stats department, and we used to share it.
The idea there was, and I think, again, I think this was, put it this way, the needs or requirements for a jobber as to research into a stock were somewhat different from those of a broker. In those days, actually, we used to produce various pamphlets. They were purely factual. They were a bit like an exchange telegraph card. We used to produce the thing called Tea, Sugar and Milk, if I remember rightly, and all it had was Tate and Lyle and United Dairies and Cow and Gate, and he just said there was a capital of 25 million or whatever it was, and they paid so much dividend. And that was it. There was a sort of a fairly non-committal foreword to it.
Capitalization and
exactly.
dividends.
That's right. But I mean,
yield and gross yield.
It wasn't, it was, well, I suppose it changed really, because when one first went there, I remember, and it was a question I absolutely loathed, broker would walk up to you and he'd say, what is the price of Cow and Gate? And you'd say, 2 Bob Clo Clo, and what do you think of them? To me, the jobber. And I loathed that question because, I mean, the odds were that I had a book in them of some sort. I was either a bull or a bear. And it was very difficult. I mean, supposing one was a bull of, I don't know, 100,000, 2 shillings a share, or too much. But you're hardly likely to say, well, you think they're very expensive and they're going down to 1 and 6. And vice versa, if you were short, you wouldn't sort of say, well, that's the cheapest share there in the market. And I always felt it was an unfair question. But anyhow, we used to have a little fly leaf there, which gave the facts and figures. We used to call it an Oscar, I think, didn't we? And it had roughly what I mentioned that was in the book, and so you used to say, oh, well, they yield 5% and this and that, and you tried to give a non-committal answer. But that was before brokers had their research department, because they would be saying quite definitely that Cow and Gate were cheap and telling their clients to buy them. And it was always a great relief to me when that people rarely ask that question.
The most important part of the information that you glean from an Oscar
yeah.
was the running yield against the price.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they used to compare that. In the brewery market yeah. Across that sector, right?
Yeah.
That's these geographically spread here. And why does this one yield 7.5% and that one yield 3%?
Yeah.
And if there was ever a takeover, that was all we had to go on.
Yeah.
You didn't know the You didn't look at the dividend cover, you didn't look at the asset backing, anything like that. But it was very primitive research.
What was your role as a jobber during a takeover in the 1950s or 60s?
Well, in the 70s and 80s, we had to make up our minds within 30 seconds, 1 minute, as to what we were going to call the shares. And also, we then had to adjust our prices in all the other companies who were competitors, because it might have put them on a different yield basis. So it was pretty hectic stuff.
Did you, as a big firm of jobbers, ever exercise much of an influence over the way in which a takeover bid went?
Oh yes, very much so. until rules came in to stop us. If I can start backwards, the last one where we could have influenced a bit and enabled it to go through quicker than it did, because it actually went through afterwards, was the when Ernie Harrison of Rakel took over DECA. And I remember a meeting with the Seabags, the brokers in our boardroom, and they said, but this only means a matter of 25,000-30,000 shares. Surely you can sell them to us. We said, we haven't got them. And no company was allowed to declare a short position from a market maker as stock assented to the bid. And I remember being under tremendous pressure. But in point of fact, if we'd have done that, not only would we have been at fault and have been heavily censored, so would have Seabags. And then if the company themselves knew that they were declaring non-existent stock, they would have been censored too. So we were protecting really the brokers and the company. But going back to before then, well, you can talk about that gentleman Margulies.
Oh. Yes, that wasn't a controlling interest, but you certainly could. You could sell a bear. You didn't have to declare anything in those days. Of course, every deal now has to be declared. And a director deals, he sells one share. I mean, we've got
but you sold an enormous bear to Margulies through his brokers, and off that he launched. He used that as a springboard to launch his bid.
Yes, he did the dirt on us too.
Before we got our bear back.
Yeah, very much so. But I suppose when one of the first ones I remember was when Charlie Claw bid for Watney's. Do you remember that?
I do.
And of course it created enormous interest. I mean, we welcomed them. I mean, quite often you would find yourself initially, you'd be short of the stock, the company receiving the bid. And it might cost you quite a few £1,000s, but it created the position, or rather the turnover, so you were able to turn your book, turn it round, and get straight, and just turn over. You've jobbed out, as we said, that loss. So it was always, it was fun. If you had it, created interest, there was a market there, and it was fun, and you just sort of took it on the jaw, and took it on the chin, and got on with the job. Mm-hmm. And if there was a lot of turnover, you could hopefully make that loss back pretty quickly.
Did you have cases of jobbers becoming too close to brokers or too close to outside companies?
I don't know. I mean, jobbing was a very personal thing, wasn't it, really? Some people, I mean, Basil Sharp, if you like, he was an amazing man, but he knew, I should think, better. He dealt in an enormous number of shares, and he did know quite a lot of them. But my own theory of the way I worked it out was that I preferred in latter days to know what the brokers wanted to do. Okay, if you knew why as well. But don't forget, if one broker was thought the shares were cheap and was recommending a purchase, there might be another one who equally was saying, well, they're expensive, and if I could stand in between those two and buy from one and sell to the other, that was me. I wasn't going to say, well, he's right and he's wrong. And I think
friendship could be very expensive. Yeah. It didn't matter in a share which was marketable, but we had a few friends, and they always used to want to deal with our firm. And they used to arrive on your pitch, and they used to say, Robert, I want to buy 25,000, this, that, or the other. Name bloody well, there was only a market in 1,000 shares. And it was almost blackmail through the friendship, so you felt obliged to sell him half the stock to start with. No, you probably hadn't got a chance of getting it back at anything like that level. Then another situation we had, for which we were very severely criticised by many brokers, was the friendship which grew up between ourselves and the fund manager of the BP Pension Fund, a man called Jack Butterworth. And he used to go around to our offices with a list of buys and sells, amounting to millions, vast great orders in those days. And we used to go around and ask each pitch, without disclosing which way, whether buyers or sellers, and where possible, execute those orders. And where we weren't commercial, then we used to hand those orders back, and he used to give it to another broker. Or if he thought that we had a better chance of executing that order because we were bigger than other jobbers, he might leave it with us for a time. That created, and then we used to tell the brokers that this stock has been allocated to you. You have bought 100,000 distillers. And then we used to get Casanovas and say that you have sold 50,000 borax. And they didn't like that at all.
It was, strictly speaking, we were breaking the rules. But he was unique, old Jack Butterworth. And it suited us because we had the business. And therefore we treated with a certain amount of discretion. And of course the brokers couldn't say too much. He only dealt through four or five brokers in any case like this. And it was big commission to them. And I suppose very occasionally we might have booked your distillers at 21 and threepence, and the broker had handled him, he might have got them at a penny halfpenny. But
even before then, we had an account with Harley Drayton, which I don't think anybody who's still on the market would know about today. They decided they wished to build up a substantial holding in brewery shares, and there was nobody else they could go to. So we had this Harley Drayton account, and we used to just deal through one broker. When we used to get the stock in, we used to say, right, bring him up, or go around and see them. Say, right, we've managed to buy an extra, at the end of each day, dealing, you bought an extra 5,000 here or 50,000 or, sorry, we haven't dealt for you.
Did you, as jobbers, have much contact with shops? That is to say, brokers who acted on behalf of the directors in companies, and who, well, I believe in the earlier days of the stock exchange, effectively could run a market.